Thanks a lot. So now the last speaker of the session will be Ann Bank from Novocell. And as I said, Novocell is pretty much the world leader in directed differentiation of beta cells from ES cells in case we can't make them from pancreas.
To share with you the work that we've been doing at Novocell to try and engineer a human embryonic stem cell to create a cell therapy to treat insulin-requiring diabetics. So diabetes is a 21st century epidemic. It's the sixth leading cause of death in the world, with 246 million cases worldwide and 380 million expected by the year 2030. In the United States alone, there are more than 30,000 new cases of type 1 diabetes diagnosed every year. So the long-term consequences of diabetes, amputations, kidney failure, blindness, are devastating not only to the patient, but to the society as well. Prompting this ongoing search for safer and improved ways of controlling glucose. So really the best solution to cure diabetes is both long-term islet cell protection and cell replacement. So currently in the clinic, there are two cell replacement therapies that are being used. One is the whole pancreas transplant, which is a pretty radical step to take. The second is known as the Edmonton Protocol. In the Edmonton Protocol, islets are purified from donor pancreases, and then they're infused through the portal vein of the liver where they lodge and they go on to function. So since 2000, more than 550 patients have been transplanted successfully using the Edmonton Protocol. Depending on the study you look at, 45 to 85% of these recipients achieve insulin independence within 1 year. It's really great. This type of cell therapy really works. However, the 5-year follow-up numbers are sobering, with less than 10% retaining function, suggesting that in this therapy, the islets would need to be replaced. In addition, another drawback of these cell transplantation paradigms is that chronic immunosuppression is necessary. So the patient is basically trading their diabetes for the side effects of immunosuppressive drugs. And as well, there's a limited supply of pancreases. There really are not enough cadaver islets to go around. So in Novocell, we've been working on developing ways around both of these problems. As far as the limited supply of pancreases, we're proposing to use human embryonic stem cells as a replenishable source for transplantable islets. And as far as chronic immunosuppression, we've developed an encapsulation technology that I'm going to touch on at the end of the talk. So why human embryonic stem cells? Human embryonic stem cells are capable of large-scale expansion. We can see scaling this as a product of up to 250 population doublings per year. And as cell lines go, they're remarkably karyotypically stable. In addition, we know that human embryonic stem cells can recapitulate embryonic development, giving rise to the three major germ layers of the embryo, the ectoderm, the mesoderm, and most importantly, the endoderm, which we know will go on to produce the pancreas. So how do we get from here, embryonic stem cell, to here, our gold standard, the human pancreatic islet? So as you've heard from the other speakers, this is a cross-section through a human islet. It has this typical architecture with the beta cells in blue here, clustered in the center and studded by glucagon cells on the outside. And it's really an exquisitely functioning organelle that can secrete insulin in response to very specific concentrations of glucose. So the approach that we decided to take was to use developmental biology as a guide. And in the next slide, I'm just going to summarize, and I don't need to belabor this because Jim did such a great job of describing it. And in fact, this is a diagram I've lifted from a review that Jim wrote. I just wanted to briefly summarize how the pancreas develops. So we start off with an definitive endoderm sheet. This is a mesenchymal sheet of tissue. It undergoes epithelialization and rolls up into a tube. And from the foregut portion of this tube buds off the pancreas. This bud then goes on to grow and undergo branching morphogenesis. And eventually will give rise to the three lineages of the pancreas, the ductal cells, the acini, which make the exocrine cells, and the islet. So over the last 10 years or so, there's really been just an amazing amount of progress in understanding the molecular mechanisms that underlie this process, such that Discrete stages have been delineated. We know something about the signals that are responsible for inducing each of these stages. And as well, there's a panoply of markers available that define the cells as they transition through each stage from endoderm to foregut to pancreatic endoderm and finally to endocrine cells. So how do you harness developmental biology to direct stem cell differentiation? So the embryonic stem cell is a pluripotent, self-renewing cell, and it can be somewhat of a loose cannon. You can keep it in the undifferentiated state if you have the appropriate culture conditions. And you can also force it to differentiate down various lineages if you expose it to the right factors. So directed differentiation of a stem cell is really a function of three things. The first is the cell lineage. In our case, we want the cells to go through specific lineages from embryonic stem cell to definitive endoderm to pancreatic endoderm and finally to endocrine. The second is time, and that's indicated in this diagram by these concentric circles. So quite often, for a cell to progress from one stage to the next, it really has to experience the previous stage. And finally, the niche or the milieu that the cell finds itself in. Not only the factors that you expose the cell to, but the factors the cells themselves are expressing. And that's really indicated here by these quadrants. So the key is to keep the cell on this sort of straight and narrow pathway and not let it wander off such that you get an efficient conversion of the cells to your target cell. Okay. All right, so we have at NovaCell developed a directed differentiation protocol to take human embryonic stem cells all the way to hormone-expressing endocrine cells. This is a five-stage protocol. There were a couple key things that I wanted to point out. One is that as we develop the protocol, at each step, we use multiple markers. Not one marker is not sufficient in any case to identify a cell type in these transitions. This protocol was developed in a very systematic way, on the one hand using developmental biology, but on the other hand, there was a lot of empirical work that was done in determining the base medias, the supplements, and the time spent at each stage. Now, right now, the protocol is about 15 days, and we think this is really important, that the transitions through each stage be relatively rapid, because it keeps the culture synchronous, and we think that the differentiation is much more efficient then. So I've highlighted here some of the key factors in the first stages. We use activin to make the definitive endoderm, which is marked by SOC17. We use KGF for FGF10 to induce the foregut endoderm stage, and finally retinoic acid to take it towards the pancreatic endoderm stage. Now, we've published several papers describing this protocol in great detail, and so I'm not going to go over that today. I'm going to jump in right here at this pancreatic endoderm stage. So this is a micrograph of a typical field of embryonic stem cells that we've differentiated to the point where they're making pancreatic endoderm. And the markers that we're using here are PDX1 and NKX6.1. Now, PDX1 marks not only the pancreas, but also marks the posterior stomach and the duodenum. Now, but if you combine NKX6.1 and PDX together, as you can see in this double exposure here, together these markers more definitively define the pancreas. Now, if we continue on this differentiation, these cells will eventually give rise within a few days to pancreatic-like endocrine cells that express insulin, glucagon, ghrelin, somatostatin, as well as pancreatic polypeptide. So initially we were very excited about this work, but when you look at these cells more carefully that we've produced in vitro, the in vitro insulin-expressing cells, first of all, they're polyhormonal, so they not only express insulin, but they'll co-express glucagon or somatostatin as well. Secondly, they do not maintain the expression of PDX and NKX6.1. These are two transcription factors that we know are absolutely essential for the function of the insulin-expressing beta cell. They have reduced levels of pro-insulin processing. The pro-hormone, pro-insulin is processed to C-peptide and insulin. This is about 50% what you would expect in a mature endocrine cell. And as well, most importantly, they do release insulin in response to some secretagogues like potassium chloride or IBMX, but they do not release insulin in response to glucose. So we've continued to work on this problem of producing beta cells in vitro, and we are making some progress. But in the meantime, what we really wanted to know was the pancreatic epithelium that we were making in vitro that co-expressed PDX and NKX6.1, it had all the hallmarks of tissue that should be able to go on and make appropriate beta cells. And why it wasn't doing it in vitro, we didn't know. It was something we were working on. But we went on then next to ask the question about what if we were to take this tissue and transplant it into a mouse? Would it then go on to differentiate normally? So to do this experiment, we took the pancreatic endoderm. We actually chopped it up into small pieces so it forms these little aggregates. We transplanted the aggregates into immunoincompetent skid beige mice. And as a transplantation site, we used the epididymal fat pad in the male mouse. We then let these mice go for several months to see if these cells would undergo in vivo maturation. And then we went on to look at them to see whether or not the cells were functioning. So the functional test that we used is known as a GCSIS assay, where we looked at glucose-stimulated insulin secretion. So basically, we take mice that have the cells transplanted in them. They're IP injected with glucose, and then we measure at different time intervals whether or not specifically human C-peptide, the byproduct of proinsulin processing, is produced in the mice, and we're using human-specific ELISAs. So it's kind of a complicated graph, and I want to start over here on the left. These are the controls. So these are actual human islets, human donor islets that were transplanted. And you can see here at time zero, this is the basal level of serum C-peptide. It's a reflection of the amount of insulin, human insulin that's being produced. And within 30 minutes of the glucose stimulation, you see this nice increase, and it goes up even further at 60 minutes. Now, these are six examples of mice that were transplanted with our pancreatic epithelium that we had made from human embryonic stem cells. So you can see at 30 days, there's not a lot going on. Basal background levels of insulin being produced. But in some of the mice, even as early as day 44, now you can start to see nice glucose-stimulated insulin secretion. Sorry. Right here. And by 71 days, all of the mice are responding, and they're maintaining it out in this assay to 94 days. So in summary, we looked at 105 mice that were implanted, 96 of these mice G-cysts, and overall we had a 91% success rate at all sites. So we not only transplanted cells into the epididymal fat pad, but we also looked in the kidney capsule and in the subcutaneous site. So it's certainly not site dependent. And as well, the subcutaneous site is really a clinically relevant site where these cells could be transplanted. Okay. Now, what we did is we wanted to know what the cells look like that had been produced histologically. We sacked the mice, and here you can see just an H and E stain of one of these grafts. We've had pathologists analyze these grafts, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit more in detail later. But this particular graft was judged by pathologists to be 100% pancreatic cell types, endocrine and ductal. Now, when you stain them with antibodies for islet hormones, here we our insulin cells at NovaCell are blue, actually. You can see this, again, this typical architecture of a human islet with the insulin cells in a core in the middle and then studded by somatostatin and glucagon on the outside. Right? And as well, we use a human nuclear marker to show that the grafted cells are all human in origin. So these are making islet structures that are frankly indistinguishable from the control human islets that we transplanted. All right, so really the next question that we had was, could these cells cure a diabetic model mouse? And to do this experiment, we took advantage of the fact that the chemical that Anil had mentioned, STZ, or streptozotocin, specifically kills mouse beta cells. It's toxic to mouse beta cells, but not to human beta cells. And this is thought to be because it's taken up through the glucose transporter 2, which is on a mouse beta cell, whereas the human beta cell is thought to use the glucose transporter type 1. So taking advantage of this fact, what we did was we took mice and we implanted them with our pancreatic epithelial cells here at day 1. And then we started measuring blood glucose levels in the mouse. And as the graph develops, you can see rising levels of human serum C-peptide from 100 to 300 to 500 picomolar. Now, at this point, we took this mouse and we treated it with STZ. The STZ will kill the mouse beta cells, but the prediction is it shouldn't hurt the human beta cells. We let the mouse go here for 50 days, about, and our assumption is that now it's the human transplanted cells that are regulating glucose in this animal. So to test that definitively, we then went on to explant the graft, the human graft, where we removed it, and then you see that the mouse becomes, frankly, hyperglycemic, suggesting that the human graft was able to maintain normal glycemia of this mouse over this last period. Okay. So just to summarize the first part of the talk here, I think I've shown that we're able to recapitulate pancreatic development with human embryonic stem cells. So here in the first step, and I didn't talk about this today, though, but we can make definitive endoderm in an extremely efficient way. It's a typical field. It's all stained with SOC17. These cells will then go on to form pancreatic epithelium, and this is something I didn't talk about today either, but these cells will actually, in culture, in vitro, branch, just like a pancreas will. And then finally, if we transplant them in vivo, they'll go on to make what looks like a perfectly normal human islet and ductal cells as well. So the significance of this work is we feel it's really the first demonstration of GCIS comparable to that of human islets and a diabetes animal model cure with human embryonic stem cell derived beta cells. It's reproducible. We've demonstrated it with two different human embryonic stem cell lines, and if you've heard, there can be differences from line to line, but this seems to be a protocol that we can transfer amongst different lines. 91% of the mice that we've engrafted, and of course we have more now since the paper was published, show GCIS. These grafts are durable. We've seen them maintained for as long as 377 days post-implant, and this is probably actually getting to the sort of lifespan of the mice we're using, these skid beige mice. So we think that they would likely be maintained even longer. And as well, it's independent of delivery site. It's achieved after implantation in epididymal fat pad, sub-Q, under kidney capsules. And it's been achieved in two different strains of mice, skid beige and nude, as well as in nude rats. We think this validates the potential of human embryonic stem cells as a source for the production of renewed human islets. And it really now focuses on the development of this technology as a diabetes cell therapy. Okay. All right, so what's required for a diabetes cell replacement therapy? It has to be renewable, which we think is certainly feasible with human embryonic stem cells. It has to be the stable source. There has to be a process for manufacturing and scaling up a safe product composition, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And there has to be some safe way, preferably non-immunosuppressive way of delivering the cells. Okay, so what started out for us is sort of a proof of principle that the pancreatic epithelium that we were making could actually go on to differentiate appropriately has become a product concept. So we're proposing to use the pancreatic endoderm progenitors as a cell product to cure diabetes. And there are certainly pros and cons to this proposition. So the pros are it's robust. Really, it works extremely well. And it's reproducible in vivo. And I should point out that one of the drawbacks of using actually islets that are isolated from cadaveric pancreases is that they're extremely sensitive, notoriously sensitive to hypoxia. And we haven't proven this yet, but we're proposing that this might not be the case for the progenitor cells we're using. They seem extremely stable, actually. As well, these progenitor cells are basically giving rise to more embryonic type islets, and we think that they'll have a greater regenerative potential than old adult islets, as Anil was just discussing. The cons are that these cells are multipotent and they'll have proliferative potential. I'd say that's a con, but a pro as well, because it's likely that the cell doses will be lower. And I'm going to talk about that some more in a minute. And as well, the length of time to reach function is 30 to 90 days, but certainly a diabetic patient has time. Okay. So there are FDA regulatory concerns, rightly so. The margin of safety has to be right. The benefit must outweigh the risk. So this product is going to have to be made very, very safe. It's a worry that the cells could have proliferative potential. So any growth of the cells, it's all right if they proliferate, but this growth has to be controlled. And we know of examples of cell therapies that are already in use where the cells are proliferative. MSCs, CD34, bone marrow, cord blood. And as well, you will need to identify possible contaminating unsafe cell populations and make sure that if you have these cells and they're below a threshold that would cause a problem. We would foresee a cell product would be likely contained or be composed of the functional cells, accessory cells that could be necessary for the function, bystander cells that wouldn't matter, as well as unsafe or teratoma-forming cells, which you'd have to make sure you got rid of. So we'd have to establish the cellular composition and show that it was safe and efficacious. We published in April this year an assessment of the mice that we had grafted. We had these grafts looked at by three independent pathologists. A high number of them, 78%, were found to be composed of primarily endocrine and duct cells. However, 13% were found to have teratomas elements in that they not only had endocrine cells, but they had mesodermal elements present as well. And 2% were actually judged as actually being a teratoma, so 1 out of 46. So this is a problem we have to go around, and we have some ideas about how to do that. So this is an example of a graft that formed a teratoma. These two grafts are from a single mouse. This is a graft taken from the left fat pad here, and it's formed a teratoma. It has a lot of endocrine tissue, but a lot of mesoderm tissue as well, and then it's formed these cyst-like structures. We have recently identified an affinity reagent that will allow us to purify or enrich for the pancreatic endoderm cells up to homogeneous populations of about 90%. When these cells are transplanted, they form these nice small grafts that are judged as being comprised almost entirely of pancreatic cell types. Okay. These cells will go on to differentiate and they function as well. So finally, AnovaCell cell therapy for diabetes. The requirements would be a renewable islet source, which we think we can get from human embryonic stem cells. The cells must be safe, and we think we have ways of purifying them and coming up with safe compositions. And as well, you need a delivery method. The route of administration, a possible route is a sub-Q site. And as well, AnovaCell has developed a biocompatible PEG conformal coating that we think will be able to use to protect the transplanted tissue from immune rejection. Okay. So what does this say about the future of insulin-producing cell transplantation? So islet cell transplantation is really still in its infancy, and it's hampered by the problems that we discussed, that there aren't enough islets for transplantation, and immunosuppression is pretty onerous. We think that stem cell sources should really increase transplantation of diabetic patients, especially if it's combined with immunomodulators with less side effects, tolerization, or more ideally encapsulation. And that together, these technologies should transform the treatment of insulin-dependent diabetes. So I want to end just by thanking colleagues and collaborators at AnovaCell. All the animal work was done by Everett Kroon and Laura Martinson. Kanika Kadoya did all the histology. Kevin D'Amore was really instrumental in devising all the differentiation protocols. Olivia Kelly and Mark Warman did the purification studies that I talked about, and Ed Bagey is our CSO. I want to thank a lot of colleagues that have provided important antibodies to us as well. So I'll end there.